the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war!
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Thanks for joining us this week for Veterans Chronicles. Our guest is Brigadier General Steve Ritchie, the only Air Force ace of the war in Vietnam. He's a graduate of the Air Force Academy who flew 339 combat missions over Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War. During that time, he downed five enemy MiG-21 fighters.
Let's go back to the beginning. Tell me about growing up in Reedville, North Carolina. What was your life like there, and what were some of the early influences on you that you may have carried forward into later life?
Little town in North Carolina, what, 12,000 people? I played football. In fact, I played all sports. I loved sports. And maybe the greatest lesson that I learned, my dad taught me in Reedsville. Because when I was 9 years old, I had decided if I could get a car when I was 16, I'd be set for life. So I told my dad, I said, Daddy, I want a car when I'm 16. I was 9 years old. He said, fine, son. All you got to do is buy it. And I got my little rear end to work. And when I was 16 years old in 1958, I bought myself a 55 Ford Crown Victoria with 15,000 miles on it. And I loved that car. I took such good care of that car. And I often tell that story at speeches, and I ask people, would I have been quite so proud of that car and taken quite as good a care of it if somebody had given it to me? And the answer is no. Ownership. I learned ownership at 9 years old. The importance of ownership. Mm-hmm. And it's the foundation of our entire market system.
Mm-hmm. What took you from Reedville to Colorado Springs?
The Air Force Academy was brand new, out west, the best of the best. And while I had some interest in flying, I was not devoted to flying. It wasn't something that I had dreamed of. The summer before my senior year, I volunteered for a program called Pilot Indoctrination, where we got 12 rides in a T-37. Which is, you know, the very first little jet trainer that we flew in pilot mm-hmm. training. And that's when I decided this is what I want to do, and I want to fly a single-seat fighter airplane. So that's when I got excited about it.
Where did you go after the academy?
Laredo, Texas, for pilot training. Mm-hmm. Now, kind of an interesting story right along there. I was walking to class one January morning, and my left knee gave out, and I fell down the steps, and my books went everywhere, and they carted me off to the hospital and the operation on my left knee. Well, when I got ready to go to pilot training, all of a sudden, right at the last week at the academy, I get this call from somebody in the medical department said, you can't go to pilot training. I said, what are you talking about? I said, you've had major surgery within the last 9 months or whatever the reg was, and you're not allowed to go. I said, well, who has the waiver authority? Well, I found out that the chief flight surgeon at Lackland Air Force Base had the decision and could waiver. So I graduated and bought myself a ticket on my own to Lackland, made an appointment with the chief surgeon, and figured I could talk him into this waiver. So he's given me all of these reasons why I couldn't go to pilot training. Well, what if you're a crew member and your airplane goes down and you hurt your knee and you're a detriment to your crew? So I didn't want to say, sir, I'm going to be flying a single-seat fighter airplane. I'm beginning to sweat because it just doesn't sound good at all. So I figure I've got nothing to lose. I said, sir, I'll make a deal with you. He's a full colonel. I'm a brand new second lieutenant. He said, you'll make a deal with me, lieutenant? Yes, sir. What is it? I said, sir, if you'll let me go to pilot training, I promise I will not let you down. So he thought for a moment. He said, all right, I'll take that bet. You get out of here and go to pilot training.
And you didn't let him down, obviously.
Well, I was already motivated. I'm now really motivated because in those days our word meant something.
Right, right. I'm going to come back to that later, too.
I had promised.
About some of those principles.
I had promised. So I'm now very, very motivated.
Right.
So a year later when I graduated, number one in flying, number one in academics, and number one overall in pilot training, I sent him a letter in the paperwork, and I said, thank you for letting me go. And he wrote back, and he said, I made the right decision.
Tell me about going to war in Vietnam.
Flew the 104 for 2 years, right out of pilot training at Eglin Air Force Base, Fort Walton Beach. Had an assignment in the 104 to Vietnam. It was canceled. I volunteered for the 105 because I wanted to be in a single-seat fighter and was awarded the F-4, which turned out to be fortunate. So on to training in the F-4 at Homestead outside of Miami, 6 months, and then to Da Nang. 1968. They needed brand new airplanes over there. By the way, on the ramp at Homestead, it was right in the very beginning of the training program for that base. We had about 100 brand new F-4D model Phantoms. They all had less than 100 hours on them. So I got to learn to fly the Phantom in a brand new airplane. It was really great. And so then I volunteered to ferry a new airplane over to Vietnam and arrived at Da Nang on April Fool's Day, 1968, 1st of April. And it was already hot. It was already in the 90s and 90% humidity, and popped the canopy, and the stench of the open sewers hit us in the face, and I thought, you fool.
Mm-hmm.
What have you done? This has got to be hell on earth. And it was.
Mm-hmm.
So flew, supposed to fly 100 missions in those days and come home, which took 6-7 months normally. So I had 85 missions when Johnson stopped the bombing over North Vietnam.
Oh, the first time.
First time. And therefore ended up having to stay a year. Yeah, I was about a month away from coming home, so that turned in, instead of 6-7 months, turned into a year at Da Nang. But the great thing that I got to do was fly the first forward air controller fast-fact mission in the Phantom. The F-100s had flown this mission for a couple of years, a call sign Misty, out of Phuket. And the reason for the fast fact was that a typical slow-moving forward air controller couldn't operate over North Vietnam. The ground fire was too intense. So they came up with the concept of a jet fact, or a fast fact, performing a fact-type mission over North Vietnam, looking for targets, preferably what we call lucrative and fleeting targets, targets that were on the move and that would be good targets. But if we didn't have one of those, then we would look for bridges or oil storage or other targets that we knew were going to be there, and we were assigned flights from the Navy and the Air Force, and we would actually work the flight just like a forward air control. And we carried white smoke rockets, Willy Pete's, white phosphorus smoke rockets, so we could describe the target, mark the target, and then have the fighters drop their ordnance, hopefully on the smoke. Put the smoke on the target and have the fighters hit the target. So they decided they wanted to do it in the Phantom, expand it from the F-100, and they asked volunteers out of Da Nang where I was. I volunteered, got selected as one of three crews to start this first program. We went down to Phuket and trained with the Misties. We got five rides in the backseat of the F-100 over North Vietnam. Then they came up and flew with us, about three rides in our backseat, and we were checked out. Dick Rutan is one of the guys that I flew with and flew with me. Dick Rutan flew the Voyager around the world later on, and Brother Burke does all of these fabulous things with aerospace vehicle design and very, very famous team. So we had a major and two captains in this little group of the very first Fast Fact unit. And Major Doug Patterson was scheduled to fly the very first mission in history in the F-4 on the 6th of September, 1968. He was flying in the morning. I was flying in the afternoon. He aborted. I ended up flying the very first official F-4 Fast Fact mission ever and flew 95 of those missions my first tour. And that was rewarding, exciting, dangerous.
What were you flying when the first combat mission took place?
Phantom, F-4.
The Phantom.
Out of Da Nang, 1968.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've described the Phantom as maybe not your favorite as compared to the 104, but a damn good airplane.
Well, the Phantom is probably from a sentimental point of view because we were, you know, I did 800 hours of combat in the Phantom over two different tours, so there's certainly an emotional attraction to this airplane, and it is a great airplane. My favorite airplane is the 104 because it's the sports car. It's the Ferrari. It doesn't carry very much. It doesn't go very far. And it doesn't turn very tight. But it is so fast. Mm-hmm. And it has a great, great feel to it. And the roll axis is the most stable airplane I've ever flown in the roll axis. So it's a great airplane to fly in formation. And it's a sports car. So For that reason, in addition to being, in my opinion, the most beautiful fighter airplane ever built, is the reason it's my favorite. But the Phantom now is more of a workhorse. It's a truck. It's a big, powerful airplane with two big engines, and it carries a whole bunch of stuff, and it goes kind of a long way, particularly with a bunch of fuel tanks hung on it. And it does a whole lot of things. It doesn't do anything real well. Mm-hmm. But it does a whole lot of things. So it's a multi-role fighter bomber.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, and we'll continue our conversation with Air Force ace General Steve Ritchie after these messages.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. Our guest this week is Brigadier General Steve Ritchie, recipient of the Air Force Cross, 4 Silver Stars, and 10 Distinguished Flying Crosses.
Out of all the many planes you have you ever flown a MiG?
I've not, and you know what, I've been offered to fly a MiG-21 and a MiG-17. A buddy of mine has a two-seat MiG-17, and other friends have MiG-21s. And I have been offered, and I always say, yes, I would like to do it. And I don't know why, but for some reason, I don't have any real desire to do it. Mm-hmm. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that's because you were in combat against them.
Maybe that's it.
Well, tell me about that. What kind of airplane, even though you haven't flown it, how do you judge the airplane as somebody you were up against?
Well, it had some advantages and some weaknesses. It was smaller than we are. They were silver, and it made them hard to see at a distance. Small, silver. It left very little smoke trail. The Phantom leaves two great big smoke trails, and your flight of four, that's eight smoke trails. You can see a flight of four 20 miles away. It's so hard to see a MiG-21 outside of 2 miles, or even less sometimes. It depends on the angle, the sun, everything. Very hard to see, so that's a real problem. They can turn tighter. MiG-21 can turn tighter than an F-4. It has what's called a lower wing loading, which means it turns tighter. So that's an advantage for the MiG. The advantage that the Phantom has over the MiG is that we have more power with those two big engines, particularly when we get a lot of the stuff off from under the wings. And whenever we got in a fight, we would jettison any fuel tanks that we had. You get that drag and that weight off. So that gave us more power, which means we could out-zoom the MiG. So if we're going vertical, we can zoom further, which means the MiG has to fall off first, and we can fall off in behind it into 6 o'clock. So that's an advantage. We can outrun it at low altitude. The MiG-21 has a roll control problem at high Q. Thick air, fast. So we could outrun it on the deck. So that's an advantage, except it took so much fuel. But it's one of our escape maneuvers. We really got into a bind, and we had to escape treetop level, fast as we could go, and I ended up doing that one time. So that's an advantage we had. We had more weapons and much better weapons. We had a radar that they didn't have. They didn't have. If they had one, it didn't work very well. And we had a radar that worked pretty well for those days. So our avionics, our fire control, our radar, our weapons, all superior. And for the most part, our training was superior. Mm-hmm. So we had those advantages.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about the ones you were up against in terms of their flying ability?
Most of them were not very good. However, on the 8th of July, I met two of their best. Most of the time, they had very little concept of mutual support. Almost every time that I was in a combat-type situation with two or more MiGs, when one got in trouble, the other left the fight. They had very basic maneuvers. They typically operated in the horizontal. Whereas in a dogfight, you got to operate in the vertical. They had a couple of standard maneuvers. One they called a half loop, which was a chandelle. They would do a chandelle, and they would do what they call a wave down, which was sort of a slicing split S. Those were their two basic maneuvers, especially when they were trying to get away.
And predictable.
Or get by. And very predictable. So that was an advantage for us. They were controlled, for the most part, by a ground radar controller. They were told almost everything to do by a ground radar controller. So this is another huge advantage. They were told everything to do. And for the most part, they did what they were told. They were not trained or allowed to make decisions in the air. Very little flexibility. So again, a huge advantage for us.
Were you aware, I'm sure you had to have been aware, when you got number four, that it only took one more, and were you in competition with other people to become someone called an ace?
Well, three and four came on the same day, the 8th,
right.
8th of July, so I went from two to four in one mission, which is a big jump.
Yeah.
Now, there was, people thought there was competition, because a fellow named Jeff Feinstein ended up with four about the same time that I had four. But he was a backseater. He's not a pilot. And for the first time in history, the military decided that a non-pilot should be given the credit for an aerial victory, whereas the term fighter ace is a historical term that means a pilot who downs five enemy airplanes in air combat. Mm-hmm. And the Fighter Aces Association, for instance, don't recognize anybody that's not a pilot because that's not even the definition of what it is.
When we return after a break, General Ritchie describes his first downing of an enemy MiG-21 over Vietnam. You're listening to Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.
Veterans Chronicles is now available wherever you are.
Through your MP3 player.
Log on to www.radioamerica.org
and click on the podcasting icon.
Look for Veterans Chronicles. Then follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast.
You can also find the Veterans Chronicles podcast on Apple iTunes.
The Veterans Chronicles podcast.
Now online
at radioamerica.org.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. Our guest this week is Brigadier General Steve Ritchie, the only Air Force ace pilot of the Vietnam War.
In the late 60s, early 70s, political correctness was beginning to surface in the Pentagon. So the bureaucrats in the Pentagon decided that the other person in a two-place airplane, such as the Phantom, whether it's a pilot or not, had to be given the same credit as the guy who did the flying and the shooting. So, even though in many cases these guys are good guys, but and they had a role, but they don't fly and they don't shoot, in many cases they're along for the ride. Now, it can even be a detriment. If you've got someone in the back seat that, let's say, is giving you bad information, it's worse than no information. You're in a high-performance combat dogfight type situation, and you get information from the guy in the back that's misinformation, and you act on that, you're either out of the fight or you're dead or a whole bunch of bad things. So it's much better to have nobody than it is to have somebody that gives you misinformation. And many of the kids were young and inexperienced, and in the beginning they put pilots in the back seat, which was a total failure because no fighter pilot wants to be in the back seat of a fighter airplane in combat, not flying. So that never worked, as we told them it wouldn't, but you know how the bureaucrats are.
Yeah.
And so then they put navigators in the back seat. And navigators don't think the same way pilots do because they're not trained as a pilot. So they have a different thought process. I'll never forget one time flying the Fast Fact mission, and I had a navigator with me, and I'm over the top, airspeed is low, I'm looking at a target on the ground, and I said, what's my airspeed? I didn't even want to look at the airspeed indicator. So this kid says, 200 knots true airspeed. Airplane doesn't fly on true airspeed. It flies on indicated airspeed. I needed to know the indicated airspeed, not the true airspeed. And it's a difference. So that's just an example of how the poor kid in the back seat didn't understand that if he'd have been a pilot, he'd have known that I needed indicated airspeed, not true airspeed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just one small example of how information, bad information, can be worse than no information. So it turns out that Jeff was a backseater, and he had four victories.
Right.
And everybody thought we're in competition. I didn't feel like we're in competition because he wasn't a pilot.
Right.
So I didn't feel like there was any competition, but there was now a lot of pressure because four is so close to five, and the Navy had an ace, and the Air Force kind of wanted an ace. So everybody said, Steve, it's just a matter of time. Well, I knew better than that because I knew any day I could be shot down and killed. Plus, there was no way I was going to risk losing a wingman trying to shoot down the 5th MiG. Our job was to protect the strike force. It was not to kill MiGs unless it was in the performing of the mission to protect the fight.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we didn't break ranks and go out looking for MiGs and leave the strike force unprotected or the chaff force. So I was even more careful as a flight leader to do everything possible to protect the strike force and the other three members in my flight and not dare risk getting one of my guys shot down trying to get myself another MiG. So I was, you know, I wasn't at all of the mindset that it's just a matter of time. I knew better than that. That was dangerous thinking.
I want to move on to what you've done since you retired from the Air Force, because you've engaged in a whole lot of motivational speaking. You travel all over the country. I know you've been very active with young people, and you impress a whole lot of things on them, including a number of principles that you have developed during the course of, 66 years?
Yes, sir.
A lot of them spent in uniform, and a lot of them spent in various civilian activities. Let's start with one thing else that I know you stress all the time, which I find a very interesting statistic. Only 4% of the members of the Air Force are pilots, and only 1% are fighter pilots. Now, that's extraordinary in the first place, but the important point, of course, is that it takes the other 96 to 99% to support the ones who do the actual flying.
Yes.
And this is a lesson that ought to really be more universally understood.
It should, because it applies to everything we do in life. Is the support team that it takes to do anything. And as I've said so many times, I wouldn't be a fighter ace. I probably wouldn't be alive if it weren't for that incredible network of people doing their job in a professional, outstanding manner day in and day out. And there, I can give you dozens and dozens of examples of what I'm talking about. But without so many people making input to operating in a combat environment and being successful and surviving, it's an amazing thing, and I am truly grateful. You know, people accuse us of being cocky and all this stuff, and I did this and I did that. I know better than that. I wouldn't even be here. We wouldn't be talking without thousands of people that made input into the fact that I was able to succeed and survive in combat.
I haven't seen any reference to an F-104 Starfighter in years. I thought they were all gone.
They are. There are only three left, and we're flying the last three in the world. And a colleague of mine named Rick Svetkov, who was in the Navy, flew A-4s in the Navy, and then went with Continental, was with Continental 20-plus years, loved the 104 as a kid. And about a dozen years ago, he was able to acquire a 104 from the Netherlands. It had been a Canadian airplane. And then he got a second one. And a colleague of mine named Tom Delashaw, who had flown combat in the 104 and the F-4 in Vietnam, taught Rick how to fly the 104. And they flew air shows together for about 7 years. And in fact, when I flew the world's only privately owned Phantom, there were two air shows where we flew together, and the two of them flew on my wing as a flight of three. And then Tom, about 4 years ago, was ferrying an old British Hawker Hunter up to Canada. It had been sold by an outfit in Florida to a group in Canada, and they hired Tom to fly it. And a lot of us who knew about this airplane knew it was not well maintained. We begged Tom not to fly it. He had a lot of time in the Hawker Hunter. And his son, the night before he left on this trip, said, "Dad, please don't do this." And he stopped in Pittsburgh, was taken off out of Pittsburgh, engine quit. He tried to get out, it was too late. So then Rick flew a single ship for several years. He was talking to me about joining the team, which I really wanted to do. I flew the 104 right out of pilot training in 1965-67. And it's my favorite airplane, too. And so I was eager to get checked out, join the team. He was able to get a third airplane, and I suggested, and Rick agreed, Mike Smith, Smitty, who had been one of the F-14 demo pilots 8 or 9 years ago and flew the F-16 with the Texas Air National Guard, is a Southwest pilot, one of the best pilots in the world. So last summer, actually a year ago, summer of 07, I got four rides in the front seat of the 104 and a check ride after 40 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And it turns out there's nobody else in the world that's had the opportunity to fly the 104 40 years later. So I feel so blessed. And this year we flew five air shows, one of them right here at Andrews. And it was the number two air show. But we flew five air shows with a flight of three F-104s that not one of the 15 countries that flew the airplane over a 50-year period ever did.
Does the Air Force itself have any connection to this?
Absolutely not. These are privately owned F-104s, the last three flying in the world. And the three of us are the only three in the world that are current and qualified in
the airplane. Now, let me ask you another sort of related question. There is no question in my mind that the young men and women who serve today are truly America's finest. They are dedicated, they are trained, they are intelligent, they are motivated, they are patriotic, they are all these things. There are a whole lot of other people out there who I don't think understand that or don't appreciate it or don't want to be quite frank about it. And what do you say to those people about, why is this your attitude? Or do you even address them?
I hate to say this, I've actually kind of given up on addressing them, because in most cases I find that you can't change their mind. So many people operate on emotion rather than fact. So many people, particularly in the political environment, think in terms of what ought to be rather than what is. And in some cases, people are open to reason and to fact and to reality. And occasionally, I have found that it's possible to have an impact on one's thinking. In fact, that's one of the things that keeps me going, is I hear from young people all over, and it's very encouraging because they say it made a difference for me. And I will even hear from people that will come up to me and say, I heard you speak 20 years ago, and it changed my life. And that is a wonderful thing. That makes it all worthwhile.
Share with our audience those five basic principles that you consider to be the most important.
Well, take advantage of every day. For the young people, to prepare for the future. There will be opportunities in the future. We don't even know what they are. If we're not prepared when they come along, we won't be able to take advantage of them. So prepare ourselves academically, physically, mentally, in every way we can. Prepare ourselves. And along the way, savor and enjoy every day. Because, as I mentioned to the young people today, as young as you are, the clock is ticking. And we never know. We never know. So let's take advantage of every day. And then we've already talked about the team. The importance of the team, and how much that means. So that's one. And then one of the things I say is, let's not take ourselves too seriously. There are a lot of people that take themselves so seriously. They think they're so important, and they're not. Every leadership position has some degree of power, and President Lincoln wrote that the true test of leadership is not only how you use power, but how it uses you. And there's so many people that Everybody knows that get into a position of power and become a different person. Mm-hmm. I've seen it in colonels and generals over and over again. And then, if we could just treat others the way we'd like to be treated, if we could just do it, I mean, wouldn't it be a different place? That fundamental, simple, golden rule, if we could just do it, and we don't seem to be able to do it in so many cases. Mm. And then the most important of all is our word has to be our bond. If our word is no good, in my opinion, there is nothing else. When it's all said and done, when it's all over, if your word is no good, if your name is no good, what else is there? What reason was there to even be here? So those are, you know, we all have little things that we live by that we learn over the years after we've been down the road a few miles, and most everybody comes to pretty much the same conclusion. And the fundamentals are preparation, teamwork, discipline, hard work, never, never, never give up, and all of that is bound together by integrity. And if we don't have those things, I don't think there's any way to be successful in the long run. You can be successful in the short run, but not in the long run, in my opinion.
Steve Ritchie, thank you very much for being with us, and thank you for your